Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Anuradha Mittal, director of the Oakland Institute, who talks about her group's recent report on real estate speculation across Africa and how that practice increases staple food prices and a rise in global hunger. Kenny King of the group Friends of Blair Mountain, who talks about a protest march in West Virginia that demanded protection for the site of a deadly battle for union rights for mountaintop removal coal mining. And John Green, executive director of the Working Families Party of Connecticut, who talks about the state's passage of the nation's first paid sick days bill for workers and interest in proposing similar legislation across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Some members of the U.S. Congress are now pressuring President Obama to reduce U.S. military operations in Afghanistan. Critics include longtime administration ally Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who now questions the expenditure of over $19 billion in foreign aid to Afghanistan over the past decade. During an early June hearing with new U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, Ryan Crocker, Kerry complained that the deployment of 100,000 American troops now in Afghanistan is neither proportional to our interests nor sustainable. The U.S. war in Afghanistan currently costs $103 billion a year. President Obama is also facing counterpressure from outgoing Defense Secretary Robert Gates and some top generals who want to limit troop reductions scheduled for July, which the president promised when he announced his surge of 30,000 additional American troops to Afghanistan last year. Meanwhile, in the House of Representatives, a growing coalition of liberal and conservative lawmakers are calling for a timeline for withdrawal of U.S. troops and for the handing over of military operations to the Afghan government. In May, an amendment to enact a timetable, sponsored by Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern, won 204 votes, including 26 Republicans. And in the Senate, Michigan Senator Carl Levin is calling for a drawdown of 15,000 troops from Afghanistan, while Indiana GOP Senator Richard Lugar warns that the large military force in Afghanistan diverts attention from other national security priorities, such as the debt crisis, energy policy, and controlling the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Florida Governor Rick Scott and state Republican legislators have rejected $19 million in funds from Washington to implement the federal health care reform law. According to the St. Petersburg Times, Florida is one of the states which is challenging the constitutionality of the individual mandate to buy health insurance, the basis of the federal health reform law. But unlike other Republican-controlled states, such as Texas and Indiana, Florida is refusing to begin planning to establish health care exchanges, the new system for offering health care coverage to the uninsured. In Pennsylvania, which is also challenging the constitutionality of the health care law, the state has already spent federal dollars to sign up citizens with pre-existing conditions like cancer and diabetes for low-cost health insurance. Governor Scott, a former health care executive, says he will not implement any section of the health care law until the U.S. Supreme Court rules on its constitutionality. The Florida legislature has also rejected multi-million-dollar grants to fund a children's hospice and the first allotment of a federal grant to keep elderly and disabled people out of nursing homes, a program which ironically was initiated by President Bush. California's policy of offering discounted college tuition to undocumented immigrants remains intact, as the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an appeal from anti-immigration activists. Under current California law, any individual, regardless of immigration status, qualifies for in-state tuition rates at public colleges if they graduated from high school in 3 years. There are currently 41,000 undocumented students in California's public colleges, about 1% of all students in the state's public university system. According to the Christian Science Monitor, 8 other states offer similar tuition discounts, including Illinois, New Mexico, Texas, and New York. A group of conservative out-of-state students filed a lawsuit against immigrant tuition discounts, saying it violated the 1996 federal immigration law, which banned offering discounts to undocumented students unless similar discounts were offered to every U.S. citizen. The court rejected the argument by asserting the discounts were not based on California residency. Immigrant advocates in California hope the Supreme Court decision will boost momentum for passage of the California DREAM Act, which will permit undocumented students to receive financial aid to pay for college. The California Assembly has passed the bill, which is now pending in the state Senate. Governor Jerry Brown says he supports the concept of the DREAM Act, but is not yet committed to signing the bill. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
A spike in staple food crop prices around the world has forced an estimated 44 million people into poverty over the past year. The International Aid and Development Group, Oxfam, recently predicted that without substantial reforms to the global agricultural system, food prices could double within the next 20 years, causing millions more to sink into poverty. Oxfam and other groups say that global climate change, speculation in agricultural commodities, and the diversion of corn into the production of biofuels are the primary causes of food price increases and the resulting rise in hunger. A related report titled Understanding Land Investment Deals in Africa, recently published by the Oakland Institute, an independent policy think tank, found that a large-scale land grab has driven local African farmers off their land and reduced food production. The Oakland Institute maintains that the same financial institutions that triggered the global recession by engaging in risky financial investments in real estate are now doing the same with the world's food supply. The consequences of increasing food prices are not limited to rising hunger, but have also led to political instability, which in turn have provoked food riots and, in some cases, the overthrow of governments. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anuradha Mittal, executive director of the Oakland Institute, who talks about her group's report on real estate speculation across Africa and how that practice relates to the rise in global food prices.
Global hunger and increasing food prices have been a subject of much discussion since 2008, when we saw the food prices increase by 83%. So on one hand, while the United Nations started pointing out that with this increase in food prices, over a billion people today are characterized as being malnourished, as being chronically undernourished, and we're talking about one-sixth of humanity, the poorest people in the poorest countries, we saw a new trend happen. Rich countries, on one hand, such as the Gulf states, who are resource-rich, but they are poor when it comes to land and water, have been rushing to, say, the poor African countries to be able to take over their lands, prime agricultural lands, so they can grow food for their own populations. You have also seen a trend of countries which might get food insecure or who are looking for opportunities to export, such as India, have also been rushing towards poor nations, for instance, in Africa, to take over these lands. And these two trends have been talked about by the media in the West. However, what has not been talked about much is also these private equity funds and hedge funds who, after the collapse of the housing market, who, with the collapse of this whole dot-com bubble, are looking for new soft commodities to invest in. So they are also headed towards places like Africa in this land rush, where they're looking for arbitrage opportunities because the prices of land are so cheap and they're so rich in bounty, close to water, all kind of investor status and tax holidays they get. They have been rushing there and securing lands so they can profit while the people of Africa are losing their most fertile lands and starving.
Anuradha, maybe you can talk a bit about some of the speculation on the food commodity markets and how that is linked in with some of the very same financial firms, global financial firms, that many point to as the trigger, their reckless behavior as the trigger for the global economic collapse that we saw unfold these last few years and certainly we're still experiencing here in the United States and around the world.
Sure. I think what we have seen over the last few years, that complete deregulation of the food commodities market. So you see private equity funds or hedge funds who have nothing to do with agriculture, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, J.P. Morgan's and Goldman Sachs, and other new investment firms that are coming up, known as alternative investment firms, who are investing and who are speculating on commodities, right, from the food commodities and setting its prices. So on one hand, while we see this skyrocketing of food prices and people blame it on increased consumption in places like China or India or growing world population, but if you look at these prices of commodities, they go up, in 3 months they go down, then they jack up again. It is really the result of the deregulation and actors who have nothing to do with agriculture being involved in the speculation. But also what this new series of reports that we have recently released, we look at a whole new trend, which is actually far more dangerous, that in addition to these funds being able to speculate on commodities, they're also now rushing to take over ownership of land, of water in countries, in places like Africa. And so they will not just dictate the price of commodities, but they will also control land and water, dictate what is grown, how it is grown, who gets to eat it. And this kind of vertical integration of a food system we have never seen before, which is very dangerous for the whole global food supply, not to mention the devastation it is causing to the communities in Africa.
I probably am guessing correctly that this is an issue that needs substantially more media coverage to educate the public about these issues that affect really everybody, because we're all buying food. Maybe we're a bit insulated from some of these bigger issues in Africa and the horrendous problem of hunger, rampant hunger in Africa. You want to just say a word about media coverage?
This story, these reports, which are based on investigation, which are based on releasing documents that have never been seen before and contracts, it is amazing that the media around the world has picked it up as the number one story this whole past week. And we have had hundreds of thousands of media impressions from radio interviews in, you know, the leading radio in Dubai. But the so-called mainstream press in the United States is still quiet. When NPR listeners have listened to us, it has been through BBC. And it makes you question, where is the independent media? What happened to journalists in the United States of America?
That was Anuradha Mittal, director of the Oakland Institute. To find links to the Institute's recent report and additional information on global food prices, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The fight to save an historic mountaintop battlefield site in West Virginia's coal country inspired hundreds of local residents and out-of-state supporters to undertake a 50-mile march in early June that followed in the footsteps of thousands of coal miners who marched the same route in 1921. The miners were demanding the right to join a union, in this case the United Mine Workers of America, and engage in collective bargaining, demands that resonate today as those rights are under attack in states where conservative Republicans hold power. The Battle of Blair Mountain pitted miners against police and the mine owners' private security forces, resulting in an unknown number of casualties. Eventually, the U.S. Army was called in and ended the 10-day engagement, the largest armed labor confrontation in U.S. history. The battlefield is now threatened by mountaintop removal coal mining operations that have already damaged part of its 1,600 acres stretched across 10 miles of ridgeline. The site was designated a National Historic Site in 2008, but under pressure from mining interests, the designation has been withdrawn. Supporters are now trying to get it reinstated. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kenny King, an active member with Friends of Blair Mountain, which organized the week's protest actions, along with the group Appalachia Rising. He describes the damage done by mountaintop removal and the impact he hopes the protest march will have on protecting the historic mountaintop.
Right now, what used to be Massey Energy is now Alpha Natural Resources. They have one called the Camp Ranch Surface Mine, which will wipe out a large portion of the battlefield, and it's actively working, and they're within, like, right now, I think they're within 1,700 feet of the ridge line, Spruce Fork Ridge, and they're moving that way, you know, pretty quick. But that's the only active one right now. There's a couple more that's been permitted by the state, and they just approved another 50.3-acre site amendment to a larger permit for Mingo Logan, And then you have a Atkins Fork surface mine, which is 332.9 acres, which will completely wipe out the southern end of the battlefield, including a lot of sites that were occupied by the actual miner, marching miners. So, you know, that area there is super important because it's got sites associated with both sides of the conflict. So that would be super important to protect right there.
So I interviewed some people along the march route, some of whom were supportive and some of whom weren't. And I've talked to a number of people in the state who think mountains are really useless, and it's better if you flatten them out, and then you can have industry and golf courses and prisons and different things. What do you say about that?
As far as putting the industry up there, there's probably already in Logan County alone, I would say close to 40,000 acres that has already been flattened. And I would say when you count the permits that are being applied for and in the process, that you're looking at over 50,000 acres, which is coming close to 20% of the whole land mass of the county. And I don't see any development, very little, very little. Well, matter of fact, the governor has a industrial park on one of the mountaintop removal sites, and I don't believe there's anything up there. Nobody wants to put anything up there because of the cost. You have to pump water up there constantly, and then you got to travel. You know, you got to climb the mountain and all that. So usually it's out in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing there. People don't want to locate in places like that.
Now, one thing he said, he also said that that's what they would do, and that he says nobody wants to go see the mountains. I guess he doesn't know about all the tourism in mountain states, but what do you...
Okay, you got the Heffer-McCoy Trail. That's all about mountains. That's mountain trails. That's why they come in here, to ride these trails and see all these beautiful mountains, beautiful scenery and all that. I mean, that's ridiculous. They got nothing, really. They got no argument whatsoever. They know it, and, you know, they're just desperate to come up with some little silly thing, you know.
But, the other thing several people told me was, aside from development, they said there's way more wildlife on the mountaintop flattened sites than there was on the mountain itself, even though, you know, apparently it has more mountains in general. Appalachia has more biodiversity than almost anywhere in the world. But they said, I mean, these guys were saying, I go up there hunt all the time, and there's deer up there, and there's rabbits and all these things I never used to see. But do you think it's just because they never saw them because the trees were in the way?
I said, yeah, that's what I was going to say. If you got two miles of clear open field grass, you're going to see something out there. I mean, this may seem like there's more. I don't know if there's been any scientific tests or studies done on it yet, but if there were, I'm sure they would show that all this has been bisected. You know, it's been just cut apart so much that it has to be affecting their habitat now. I mean, these deer are not going to go out in the middle of these big fields on a hot summer day and lay down or eat or whatever. They're going to go into the forest land where it's cool and where the water is and all that, you know. And that's ridiculous.
So just tell me briefly, you've been working, what, is it 20 years?
Yeah.
Okay, so you've been working 20 years on this. And then there's people in the last maybe 5, 10 years that have really started building a real movement around ending all mountaintop removal. So how did you guys, the two organizations, Appalachia Rising and Friends of Blair Mountain, how'd you come together?
Well, we got a common cause, I guess. You know, we're about preserving the history, and you can't separate it now because of all the mountaintop removal. You have to consider that because that's the biggest threat. I mean, you know, so we just got a common cause, I guess. You know, is we're both working for the same thing, pretty much.
And what do you hope or think, predict will come from this week long march and this gathering and the march up the mountain?
Nothing else, a lot of national attention, then maybe some people will start wondering about it, and maybe they'll start contacting their politicians or whatever and try to, you know, convince them that there's got to be something done. We're going to have to search for a different fuel source and all that, and we can't keep on going down the same road we're going. We got to do something.
That was Kenny King, a board member with Friends of Blair Mountain. For more information on the groups fighting to save Blair Mountain, visit our website at btlonline.org. The 2010 congressional ballot was tagged as a change election across the country, with big wins for Republicans and Tea Party activists. The conservatives' most visible victory was their takeover of the House of Representatives, while making gains in the U.S. Senate. But the GOP also dramatically increased their control of state legislatures from 14 to 26, while winning total control of 21 states' governor seats and legislatures. In contrast, Democrats now reign in only 11 states, down from 16. Bucking the tide of November's Republican sweep, the state of Connecticut elected its first Democratic Party governor in 20 years, with Democrats retaining control of both houses of the state legislature. In his first 6 months in office as the state's new governor, Daniel Malloy and the legislature decriminalized possession of small quantities of marijuana, passed a bill to protect transgender citizens, established an early prisoner release program, increased taxes by $1.4 billion, and enacted a bill to mandate a specific set of employers in service-related industries to provide paid sick days to their workers, the first of its kind in the nation. Proponents of the new sick leave legislation was the Working Families Party of Connecticut that campaigned hard for the bill over the last several years with allies including unions, religious leaders, small business owners, and public health advocates. Among opponents were Walmart, Burger King, and CBIA, the state's largest business association. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Green, executive director of Connecticut's Working Families Party, who talks about the benefits of the paid sick days bill, how they won passage, and interest in proposing similar measures across the U.S.
You know, the issue of paid sick days is one that I think a lot of people do tend to take for granted, certainly sort of white-collar employees or professional employees mostly get paid sick leave and kind of assume that other people do as well. But the reality is that among hourly employees and especially low-wage employees, an astonishingly high percentage do not receive any paid sick leave. Among low-income workers, it's about three-quarters of low-wage workers who don't receive any paid sick time. And so what this bill will do, it's not asking for an enormous amount, but it allows employees to earn up to 5 paid sick days per year. The paid sick time is earned on an accrual basis. So employees will earn 1 hour of paid sick leave for every 40 hours that they work, up to a maximum of 40 hours annually. And that time can be used to recuperate from an illness, to care for a child or a spouse when they have an illness, for medical appointments, or to get services relating to an incidence of family violence or sexual assault. So for those reasons, this will make, I think, the lives of several hundred thousand, mostly low-wage employees, mostly women, make their lives a little bit easier in that they'll have a little bit of economic security when they happen to become ill. I think there's also a very important public health aspect to this policy, because what we have found is that the employees who tend to not have paid sick leave are concentrated in exactly the industries where you wouldn't want people coming to work sick. So, for example, daycare providers or home health care aides or nursing home workers or restaurant employees. These are the occupations that have the least paid sick leave coverage currently. And under this bill, many of those employees will now have this benefit. So it's not just a question of fairness for the employee. It's also a question of health. You know, do you want the person who is taking care of your child at the daycare center or taking care of a parent or grandparent in a nursing home? Do you want that person to feel compelled to come to work when they have an illness? It's just sort of common sense that that shouldn't happen.
John, what would you say the most significant compromise that had to be made in order to get passage of this bill?
You know, the legislative process is a process of compromise. There was certainly negotiation and give and take along the way. The biggest change in the bill by far was that it was narrowed to really apply to service workers. So it's not universal, doesn't cover every employee in the state. It does apply to businesses with 50 or more employees, which is similar to the way the Family Medical Leave Act works. And it applies to service workers. And that's been reported as, you know, in various media sort of a major concession, but I got to tell you, when we look at the practical side of this in terms of which types of employees would genuinely benefit from this bill, we're really talking about service workers anyway. What we found is that in the manufacturing sector or in, IT or utilities or other, higher paying jobs, most of these employees, the vast majority, were already receiving benefits that were comparable to what this bill required. It really was in the service industry when you talk about restaurant workers and school bus drivers and daycare providers and home health aides. That's where we really found that these benefits weren't being provided by the employer. So, my view is that focusing on those workers was really, that just meant we're covering the people who don't have it now. Didn't seem like an enormous amount to give up in terms of substance, but I do think, from the point of view of sort of symbolism or the cosmetics of it, it was helpful in terms of getting the bill passed.
What's been the reaction nationally to this groundbreaking legislation, John? You have a lot of interest from cities and states who want to try something similar in their own backyard?
I think it's definitely beginning to sort of percolate up in a bigger way than it has in the past. Philadelphia is considering a paid sick leave policy that I think will be voted on by their city council within the next couple of weeks. In New York City, there's a rebirth of interest in this issue. They're going to have mayoral elections coming up not too far down the road, and people are beginning to look at themselves and position themselves. And this is one of those big issues that is going to help define that race. And I think, the overwhelming majority of New Yorkers strongly support a paid sick days policy. And I think that's going to play out in the municipal politics of New York and will likely lead to a victory there sometime relatively soon. And there's places like Seattle and Denver that are considering this. I think Massachusetts, in terms of states, Massachusetts could well be the next state to do it. You got to remember, looking at things like child labor laws or the 40-hour work week, things we just sort of take for granted now, began at the state level. And it took time, but over a period of decades, those policies became the norm and ultimately federal law. I expect that something like paid sick days will follow a similar trajectory.
That was John Green, Executive Director of the Working Families Party of Connecticut. Find links to more information about Connecticut's paid sick days legislation by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.